Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for your nice introduction. And it has been quite nice to interact with my colleagues here and exchange ideas and see what's going on in Toronto. But I also welcome the opportunity to tell you about the program that we've been developing and carrying out at Triumph, which has a twofold or a multifold interest, and one of the interests is nuclear physics. So I will try to explain to you how we see that we can get a little bit closer in understanding the universe using rare isotopes. And the tool of choice for me in this case is using ion traps. So let me introduce to you what I mean by understanding the universe. This is something that we're trying to capture in a number of questions, and when I say we, this is actually a common quest of the worldwide community concerned with nuclear physics. You see here the long-range plan of the European nuclear physics community, the Canadian, and the US, and the questions that we are trying to address and how they are linked to understanding the universe are summarized here. What binds protons and neutrons into stable nuclei, or atoms if you wish? Or what makes them rare isotopes, and where are the limits of nuclear existence? When can you no longer add neutrons or protons to them? What that actually means is we are trying to gain a fundamental understanding of strongly interacting matter. We're trying to move away from something that has been governing nuclear physics for a century, namely a descriptive model, and we want to move to something that is predictive, a theory that works for all of the nuclei, for all of the isotopes that we know are out there. When and how did the elements that are heavier than iron and lead all the way up to uranium, when and how do they originate? We still don't know what makes the observed element abundances in the universe, and there's a clear connection to nuclear physics to that. What is the origin of simple pattern in complex nuclei? Or if you turn that around, where does symmetry affect nuclei? And can we use that to understand symmetry concepts that shape the universe? This is something where rare isotopes play a very dominant role. And last but not least, what causes stars to explode? The life and death of stars is obviously governed by nuclear reactions as they fuel the energy production in stars. And during that process, particles are emitted, neutrinos, light, etc., and that helps us understand better how the universe functions. Not so fast. I figure there is probably not a lot of nuclear physics expertise here, so let me introduce to you what are rare isotopes, why do I think that these are important questions, and how do we go about in answering them. So this is a recent Nature publication, and what you see here is a chart of nuclei. Protons going up this way, neutrons going in that direction, and everything you see here in black are the stable nuclei. It's about 288 stable or very long-lived nuclei, and by long-lived nuclei, I mean nuclei, they live long enough so they actually contribute to the natural abundance. But what you see here in this publication, they came up with a description to understand how many bound isotopes we can actually expect in the universe. And currently, we can expect about 7,000. So everything else that is not stable is rare or radioactive. So this is what we're dealing with. And what do we do with those? We would like to come up with a theory that would be able to describe all of those 7,000 isotopes. As I said, only 288 are stable. And what you see here is, again, the chart of nuclei, and overlaid in color code are the different theoretical approaches that are currently used to describe them. As you see, they only function in certain areas. And by that, you have a clear understanding that they have limited predictive power. And you need to overlap them. And so ultimately, what we would like to have is something that describes with one single theoretical approach everything that we have out there. Why do we want to do that? Well, from an academic point of view, it's clear. We'd like to explain what holds atoms together in the innermost. That's what drives me. That's what I would want to understand. But there's more to it. There are applications out there, applications like in nuclear astrophysics, and we'll come back to that. So this is the understanding of where the heavy elements in the universe comes from. Perhaps this is something that we can also apply for energy. If you are able to understand what holds them together, you would also know what you need to do to break them apart. So that would be a potent way to get rid of nuclear waste. If you are able to predict what kind of mechanism is needed to manipulate them, to go from a long-lived radionucleus to a very, very short-lived one. And within a second or so, you could get rid of that, perhaps. But another application would be for medical applications in tumor therapy and diagnosis. As I said, there are 7,000 isotopes expected out there. 288 are stable. Currently, we know something about 2,800. Radioactivity has been known for a century, so it took us a century to get experimental information about 2,800. We will not be able in our lifetime to cover all of these 7,000 experimentally. Theoretically, we can describe them if you have a theory that predicts their properties with some resolution. Then you perhaps could know where medical applications, let's say with the right half-life, with the right decay properties, could be applied, and then you can go and look for them. So there's more interesting applications for having such a theory. This nuclear astrophysics application that I was talking about was summarized a couple of years ago when they talked about the 11 greatest unanswered questions in physics. That was based on a study in the US from the National Research Council, and question number 3 was exactly this. So we know in a normal star, you can only generate fusion that goes up to iron or nickel if you want to, and then the binding energy that the isotopes have or the atoms have is so high that you no longer gain energy by fusion. So there has to be a different mechanism. One possibility where you actually have the conditions to generate heavier isotopes, heavier than iron, up to uranium, could be in a neutron star merger. 2 to 5% of the binary stars are considered to be neutron star mergers. And I will show a simulation here from my colleague Stefan Roswalk, and that was recently published in Nature, where you see such a binary system consisting of neutron stars. Now I need to find the mouse, all right. So you need two things if you want to produce these heavy nuclei. You need a mechanism that generates the nuclei. The right nuclear reactions need to be present. And as I said, it's not fusion. It's an individual pickup of neutrons or protons. And then you need a mechanism that distributes it, because obviously we know it's out there in the universe. So generating alone is not enough. It actually has to be spread out. A neutron star would do that. So the question is, what does that have to do with nuclear physics? Well, let's go to the next step. This is what we call post-processing. You take these conditions from a neutron star merger, and you take isotopes that we are considering sit on the crust of a neutron star, so-called seed nuclei, and you expose them to the condition that you just calculated in this neutron star merger, so an influx of lots and lots of neutrons. And what's happening is, you see down here, you have your seed nucleus, and again, this is the chart of nuclei, stable nuclei, and these are all these rare isotopes out here. This is the neutron number, so if you go in that direction, you add neutrons. So far, so good. Who of you has already seen a chart of nuclei? Oh, that's very good, very good. So stable nuclei, in this direction, you have more and more neutrons. Here, you remove neutrons. In this direction, you eat eight protons. If you want to generate heavier nuclei, you need to add protons. So what we're doing here is adding neutrons that goes in that direction. But as soon as you have a severe unbalance between neutrons and protons, you undergo beta decay. Beta decay means a neutron is converted to a proton. Now we're going in the right direction. We're going up here. So I will show another movie here where you take these conditions from a neutron star merger, take these seed nuclei in the neutron star crust, and expose them at the right temperature with the right neutron flux, and it will undergo this capture reaction of neutrons and subsequent beta decay. But as we know, these are radioactive isotopes. They decay. So eventually they will decay and generate what is called a sum abundance. So everything that is left over is summarized here. Here you see temperature and density, and in color code, you will see the relative abundance during that process. So let's see if it works. So we're starting out. There are more and more neutrons coming in. They go out here, undergo beta decay, work their way up here. You see how the summed abundance dynamic behaves, and eventually it comes to a stop when the process is finished. Neutron star merger has completed. All the neutrons are soaked up. Beta decay has occurred, and this is what's left in your summed abundances. Now, this is very powerful because now you can actually take this summed abundances from such a post-processing calculation, which was carried out by my colleague Almudena Arcones, together with the group that actually does this neutron star, and you compare this abundance to observed abundances. So the proof is in the pudding. If you can actually reproduce these abundances with the observed abundances, you've done everything right. You've taken the right conditions from the neutron star merger here, and all the nuclear physics that goes in here has the right properties, and everything worked out. And by right properties, I mean how the probabilities to capture neutrons behave, how long they live, when does beta decay occur, what kind of energy is released in the beta decay. All of this has worked out. For that, we would need to have all the nuclear properties of these 7,000 isotopes that are up here. So here, we want to have an approach that is a combination between experiment and theory. The theory ultimately will be able to describe that all of those, and you need stepping stone benchmarks, theory, experimental stepping stones to refine your theory. So how do we go about in building up such a theoretical framework? You start with something that you know and trust, quantum chromodynamic. So you go all the way down here. This is, again, chart of nuclei in log-log scale. You go down to quarks and have quarks interact with each other. This is what you do with quantum chromodynamics. And in principle, you would be able to build up all isotopes, all properties of all isotopes from quantum chromodynamic. However, that would be insanely computational expensive. Currently, not really possible. So you have to be a little bit more clever about it. So we want to go from here all the way up to here. The trick is to go to the relevant degrees of freedom. You build up what is called an effective theory, and you realize that to describe isotopes, you actually don't need to use the quarks themselves. It's good enough to use the protons, the neutrons, and the pions as the relevant degrees of freedom. And that simplifies your theoretical approach significantly. However, you want to use the interaction based on this quantum chromodynamic set up in a chiral effective field theory. And this is how it goes. You set up your Feynman diagrams, and you get actually a natural ordering of two neutron interaction or three neutron interaction, and you can build up a framework completely based on chiral effective field theory, based on first principles, where you have a natural order of propagation for two and three body interaction, etc. And you want to describe that in a way that eventually allows you to describe all of those 7,000 isotopes. This is a big goal for modern science, and we have to start somewhere. You want to do precision tests to benchmark how well you can actually describe those. In order to benchmark, you need those rare isotopes. How do you get them? There are currently two approaches in how to make rare isotopes. Anybody ever heard of those approaches? Okay, very good. Oh, one. Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Bob. So there's the isotope separation online and the so-called in-flight fragmentation. With an isotope separation online facility, a so-called ISIL facility, you have a light ion driver, like a proton, and you shoot on thick targets where most of the energy stays in the target. You synthesize new isotopes based on nuclear reactions, and they diffuse out. They get ionized. At least one electron gets removed. You form it into a beam. You go through a separator unit, and you provide them to the experiments at a certain energy. The second approach is an in-flight fragmentation or in-flight fission. So here you have a heavy nucleus, a large object, accelerated to higher energies, and then you go through a thin target where you break up this nucleus. And then you separate it in flight, hence the name, because it actually comes at very high energy, and then you provide it to the experiment at rather high energy, 100 MeV per nucleon. This is what we do at TRIUMPH, and this is an approach that is currently being built up at the so-called EFRIP facility, excuse me, in the US. That is a facility that is being built in Michigan for $700 million. But there is already an existing facility at the Riken Nishina Center where they're employing such an approach, and I will come back and show an experiment from that facility later. So as I said, our isotopes come from TRIUMPH, and as you probably know, TRIUMPH is Canada's National Laboratory for Particle and Nuclear Physics. It is owned and operated by a consortium of essentially all key universities in Canada. In total, we have 18 of those. One of those is, of course, the University of Toronto. We call ourselves Canada's National Laboratory for Particle and Nuclear Physics, but we've grown beyond. We're actually heavily involved in research for accelerators. We're involved in material science, and we are also involved in nuclear medicine. What all of those have in common is to make use of the big accelerator that we have at TRIUMPH. And here you see a picture of the TRIUMPH facility located on the campus of UBC and with Vancouver and the Pacific Ocean in the backdrop. Here's a bird's eye view of that facility. The cyclotron, a circular accelerator that is able to produce an acceleration of protons up to 500 MeV with fairly high current, sits at the center of this accelerator complex. And the beauty about that is that we can actually extract multiple beams at multiple locations simultaneously. So one of those beams is, in fact, used to carry out a program in particle physics. We carried out a precision branching ratio experiment called Pi E Nu. And in the future, we're starting up a new program for ultra-cold neutrons, in particular, to look for permanent electric dipole moments. We use the same beamline to carry out molecular and material science. Another beamline leads into this complex here, the so-called ISAC complex, isotope separator and accelerator. This is the rare isotope program. And in the future, we want to add an additional production facility called ARIAL, Advanced Rare Isotope Laboratory. At ISAC, and this is where I will be talking about for the rest of my talk, we have programs to cover nuclear structure, nuclear astrophysics, fundamental symmetries, but again, also a fair fraction of material science. Here it's in a little bit more detail. Here you can actually look inside the cyclotron that is a person here, so you get a sense for the scale of this cyclotron. The proton beam comes out, hits a thick target, as I described earlier. You synthesize these new isotopes, they diffuse out, they get ionized, and then you deliver them through a separator to the various experimental facilities out here. The Titan facility, this is the experiment I'm concerned with, is located here in this area, in the so-called ISAC 1 area. To give you a better understanding of how this synthesization process actually occurs, is you have a 500 MeV proton, it hits a large nucleus, in this case uranium-238, and you have various production channels occurring simultaneously. Spallation, where you boil off some of the neutrons and protons, and you are left with a fairly large nucleus after the process. So this is now francium-208 or something like that, where you started with 238. Neutrons and protons, or fragmentation, where you break the nucleus up into two main partners, one small, one large, and some extra neutrons and protons, or fission, where you break the nucleus up into two more equal-sized partners and some neutrons and protons. In the future, we also want to use this production mechanism, where you have photons excite the nucleus and generate fission as well, and that leads to different isotopes that are produced in this fashion here. So it will enhance our overall capability of producing different kind of isotopes. This is the chart of nuclei as we've seen before, and in color code is what we've currently are able to produce. So you see it's a whole range of isotopes, and what you are producing depends essentially on your target material. The production mechanism is essentially always the same, so if you have a different target material, you get different isotopes out. So coming back, that concludes the technical part of an introduction to TRIUMF, coming back to answering the questions that we introduced earlier. And the approach that I have is coupled to atomic mass measurements. So the beauty about a mass measurement is that you actually get access to the so-called binding energy. If you measure the mass and you know the number of neutrons and the number of protons and the number of electrons, the uncertainty that you can extract is the binding energy. And with this binding energy, you include all effective interaction and essentially the nuclear potential. So you don't really have to worry what kind of interaction goes on. It's all confined in this binding energy. If you do mass measurements of two nuclei that are connected through a reaction, you get information about the energy gain that you have. For instance, what kind of energy is gained in a reaction in a star or in beta decay, as we saw in this nuclear synthesis process. Mass measurements are relevant in the understanding of the nature of neutrinos, for instance, in double beta decay. And what you see here, again, is the chart. And this is taken from the atomic mass evaluation, where people combine all the world market of masses for a specific isotope, evaluate them, and then assign the final uncertainty. And the uncertainty is given in color code. And as you would expect, the further you go away from the valley of stability, from the stable black nuclei here in the center, you go further out here, the uncertainty drops down. So this is where we come in. We have to be able to carry out these mass measurements with a certain precision. If you want to understand what's going on down here at the bottom, at the light nuclei, at the so-called halos, and I will come back to that in a second, you need roughly an uncertainty of 10 to minus 7. For double beta decay, you need to go a little bit higher. For nuclear synthesis, nuclear astrophysics, 10 to minus 7, 10 to minus 8. This is the uncertainty you need to achieve. What I will show you is how we go about in testing that fundamental approach to developing a theory where we can benchmark those, going from light nuclei, as I said here, to medium-heavy nuclei. And then I will show an application in nuclear astrophysics. So these light nuclei, they are found at the bottom of the chart of nuclei at the very extreme. All the way out here, very, very neutron-rich in the helium chain, in the lithium chain, in the beryllium chain. What they have in common is that they have strange behavior. What I mean by that is if you look at this lithium-11 nucleus, which is all the way out here, it seems to be composed of a lithium-9 nucleus and two extra neutrons that live on classically forbidden orbits. And the orbits are have a radius that is as large as the wave functions for a lead-208 nucleus with 208 neutrons and protons. This is somewhat unexpected because you basically think of a nucleus as some compact object with neutrons and protons well confined in the center. Lithium-11 does not follow that description. Why are those interesting, besides this strange behavior here, is they are few nucleon system, so you can actually calculate them based on ab initio, first principle calculations, because you can actually still count the number of neutrons and protons. But they are also at extreme conditions, a very large neutron to proton ratio. However, experimentally, they are rather difficult to capture. They are very short-lived. What you see here is helium 8, 120 milliseconds, lithium 11, the one that we talked about here, 9 milliseconds, beryllium 14, only 5 milliseconds. So all the measurements, all the preparation that you have to do has to occur within this time frame. Let's look at the helium chain in a little bit more detail. You have helium 3 and helium 4 as stable. You add one more neutron, it's unbound. Doesn't exist in nature and it's ground state. You add two more neutrons, and it becomes bound. It's short-lived, but it has a ground state. You add yet another neutron, it's unbound. Doesn't exist. Helium-8, again, exists. It's bound. It's the only system in the universe in its atomic form that goes between bound, unbound, bound, unbound, that we know of. So very peculiar behavior. With helium-8, we have the most exotic nucleus on Earth, a neutron-to-proton ratio of 3. This is as close as we will ever get to a neutron star. So this is your, you know, little neutron star in a pocket. So what you want to find out about those is, what's their shape? How is their charge distribution, the protons distributed? How is their matter distributed, the neutrons and protons combined? And then you want to confront that with theoretical predictions. And as I said, they should be based on this chiral effective field theory based on very fundamental approach. If you take a simple approach and you want to describe this lithium-11, you take this lithium-9 and these two extra neutrons and you set up a Schrodinger equation, you take any kind of nuclear potential, and you have this two neutron separation energy that separates these two extra neutrons, describes how tightly they are bound to the lithium-9 core. And you solve that equation in these two regions, and you see the extent of the wave function out here depends on that energy. So if they are very loosely bound, your wave function will go out very, very far. That's the reason why they are in classically forbidden orbits all the way out here. If you want to do a little bit more sophisticated theory, you still need to describe this exponential wave function, but you can set up a cluster model. You couple these two neutrons, have a correlation between them, and couple them to a core. And this is then a three-body model. You can describe lithium-11. And that makes it what is called a Borromean system. That means lithium-9 does not exist if you just add one neutron. It does not exist if you add the other neutron because lithium-10 doesn't exist. And the dineutron system also doesn't exist. So this is depicted here in this coat of arms from the family of Borromean. If you take one ring away, the whole system falls apart. So it's a theoretical description based on a cluster model that allows you, within this framework, to describe them. It falls short if you want to describe something that has only one neutron or four neutrons. So a more sophisticated approach is to take them individually. Set up Hamiltonians that take every single neutron and proton into account, an A-body system. Set up your Hamiltonian with two-body interaction, three-body interaction. Hence, this neutron or proton interacts with this as a two-body interaction in the presence of this. So you can set up a sophisticated Hamiltonian and actually calculate it from scratch, up initio, based on first principles. So there's a whole host of approaches, methods, potentials out there. What they all have in common is you need precision experiments to confront them with and then say, yes, that works, we're on the right track, we've benchmarked this region, let's move on. We have a theory that works here, we want to extend it to even heavier systems. The benchmarking that I do is with mass measurements, and the mass measurements I carry out are done in ion traps, and that is something that I simply call the perfect tool. Why not? So it's the perfect tool to get answers, and that stems from the fact that you have a controlled storage in a very well-defined electromagnetic field. You store a single particle for an extended period of time in well-defined fields, and that allows you to have here a large time interval to probe, and that beats down your energy uncertainty. If you choose the geometry properly, it also allows you to have interaction with laser, with RF fields, with charged particles, with atoms, and look what's coming out. So it's actually a very nice tool for multiple reasons. You can do manipulation technique, and you can do a precision measurement, in my case, with a mass measurement, because you have very well-defined fields. This is something that I have not developed. I took that from the atomic physics community, and in fact, Hans Demelt and Wolfgang Paul got the Nobel Prize for that in 1989. They came up with the idea of setting up a Henning trap, where you use the combination of a static, homogeneous magnetic field in combination with an electrostatic quadrupolar field, and that leads to very well-defined, stable trajectories, as you see in the calculation here. That is something that is extremely well suited for precision experiments because you understand the motion very well. Alternatively, you can use a Paul trap where you have alternating field, and that leads to very stable trajectories, but they are somewhat chaotic, as you see in the calculations here, composed of micromotion and macromotion, but it's extremely robust. It doesn't need an expensive magnet, and it's hence well suited for manipulation technique. The Penning trap mass measurement that I do is then a single ion quantum manipulation. I load a single particle in this combination of strong magnetic field, weak electrostatic field, and you get this trajectory in three dimensions with the projections on the three walls. And the motion is the so-called cyclotron frequency. It's composed of a component of the charge state, the mass, and the magnetic field strength. If you're able to extract the cyclotron frequency and you know the charge state and the magnetic field strength, you get access to the mass. And because frequencies is the thing that you can determine most precisely, and you have very well-controlled field, you actually get the mass out to a very, very high precision. The other point I want to make is that you actually do the measurement with one ion in the trap at the time. So it's extremely sensitive. What is the other beauty about the system? It is actually something that was developed for atomic physics. It doesn't rely on the decay or any nuclear property. It behaves exactly the same way, whether it's stable or unstable. That has a big advantage, because you actually can test your systematic uncertainties with stable particles. Behaves exactly the same, and then you load your radioactive ions in there, and that gives you a good handle of what your accuracy and your precision is. If you measure something that you know, and you have a target, you can determine your accuracy. And then you need to minimize your spread here and determine something precise. But once you're going off to the unknown isotopes, you better understand your system. And that is something that nuclear physics has suffered in the past from quite a bit. And with these precision tools, we are now in a position to find a remedy for that. So Titan is the system that I'm using, that I built up at Triumph. It's Triumph's ion trap for atomic and nuclear science, and it's composed of a number of those traps. The first one is an RFQ, a radio frequency quadrupole, a linear Paul trap that we fill with helium or hydrogen as a buffer gas and cool the ions that are produced in these brutal nuclear interactions in the target. They come out with a large energy spread in a continuous beam. They are loaded in here. They interact with the gas, get cooled down, get converted into a bunch. So it's not a continuous beam anymore, but it's also not chopped. You actually accumulate them, and then you send them out in a bunch. And you can further process them, for instance, in an electron beam ion trap, in an EBIT, remove more and more electrons. At this point, there's only one electron removed. It's an ion, a singly charged ion. If you load them into the EBIT, you can remove more and more electrons and convert them to highly charged ions. And then you deliver them to the Penning trap, and here you see a picture of this Penning trap with about 12 millimeter radius across here, where you determine the cyclotron frequency and carry out your mass measurement. So when we started out, we wanted to be sure that we understand our precision and accuracy. So we started with something that we wanted to benchmark, and we took lithium-6. Lithium-6 is stable. And we looked at the atomic mass evaluation, where all these masses are accumulated and put together. So this is the benchmark. We wanted to repeat that. And this is what we came up with. Unfortunately, it did not agree with the atomic mass evaluation. So I said, OK, it's a new system. I guess something isn't working. There's a shift there somewhere. We don't understand something. So we worked and worked and worked, but we could not reproduce this value. So we talked to the people that actually do the atomic mass evaluation and say, guys, where did you get this value from? Can you provide us more background? We need to understand this. And I said, yeah, well, basically, it's from this FISREF-A. It's atomic mass of lithium-6 in a Penning trap. And that's where it comes from. It's a single measurement. So OK, it's a Penning trap. Should be OK. That's what we have. We like that technology. Should be OK. We tried more and more, and we still couldn't reproduce it. So we looked more and more into that paper and said, what kind of group is that? Well, it's a group that works at the time and frequency division at the NIST in the US. Saying, well, shit, they probably know what they're doing. So I still couldn't make it work. But went back to the guys from the AME and said, is there any other information you have about that? Is that the only thing? He said, well, we also have the PhD thesis. Do you want to look at that? I said, yeah, we want to look at that. Turns out in the PhD thesis, there were 5 more data points that miraculously did not make it into this publication. And that the argument was that they had a vacuum leak and there was helium coming in and they couldn't trust that and, you know, they weren't so sure, so they omitted those data points. But when you include them, you actually agreed. Okay, feel a little bit better. And then there was an additional trap measurement that came along that was also confirming our measurement. I said, okay, now we have more confidence that we have a precise and accurate measurement. So this is something that we did to 4×10⁻⁹. So it's a very high precision that we're able to achieve with stable lithium. And in fact, Titan is now the most precise value used in the new atomic mass evaluation. So having built up that confidence, there are 2 things that we learned at the beginning of our career doing mass measurements. If it's in the PhD thesis, it goes in the publication. And if there are students out here and your supervisor says, that was a vacuum leak, think about it. And the second thing is that we had confidence that we actually can reproduce these values or can even push the limit of what has been known, and we moved on to radioactive isotopes. And that's what we did with this one here. So this is now lithium 11. So this is this funny nucleus with the 2 extra neutrons. And we measured, that was known before. This is our measurement here. And it's only 8.5 milliseconds half-life. In fact, we pushed it down to 650 EV, sub-KV precision. So this is almost atomic physics spectroscopy, and that was published in PRL. And here you see a more complete picture of what goes into the AME. So these are the various measurements starting from 75 all the way to 2008, and it's now completely dominated by our measurement here. But this is usually what goes into such an atomic mass evaluation. And if you have such a precise measurement, you can talk to your colleagues that do isotope shift measurements, laser spectroscopy, and from that, you can extract the so-called isotope shift, which requires a calculation of the mass shift and the field shift. If you add more and more neutrons to a lithium, you have 2 effects. You have a different center of mass movement, which is reflected in the mass shift, but also your nuclear potential gets spread out because it's distributed over more neutrons or more protons, and that gets you the field shift. And you can calculate that. This is an atomic precision calculation. And what you see here is the atomic number and the contribution from the mass shift and the field shift. And as you would expect, for light nuclei, the mass shift is dominant. It matters a lot more if you add 1 neutron to lithium-9 or lithium-10 than if you add it to rubidium-100. For that, you actually need this very high precision below 1 keV, and you can calculate then the charge radius, which gives you a feeling for how the neutrons and protons are distributed, which is something that we eventually want to compare to theory. We did the same for this funny helium chain, helium-6 and helium-8. So again, this is what was known before. This is what we came up with. And then you can talk to your friends that do the laser spectroscopy, provide them with the mass, talk to your atomic theory friend, get the mass shift calculated, and then you can derive the charge radius. And what you see here is the helium-4 charge radius, the helium-6, and the helium-8. Now let's try to understand that. So you have helium-4, which is an alpha particle, nice and compact. You add 2 more neutrons, and it turns out these 2 neutrons are so loosely bound to the core that they actually see each other more than the core. So you get a polarization here. They are not evenly distributed. They are polarized on one side. And that leads to a center of mass movement. So it wobbles the proton distribution around, which then increases the charge radius. If you add yet 2 more neutrons, you have a more homogeneous distribution, and your charge radius goes down again. So this is, of course, a classical picture. But you can also do that in a full-fledged calculation. And what you see here is a comparison of our result here, providing the mass, or the two neutron separation energy, and the charge radius compared to various theoretical approaches. And what you see here are these red dots, which are calculated with a theory called Green's function Monte Carlo, including the three-body interaction. So if you include the three-body interaction, which was not the case for this theoretical approaches, you actually get good agreement. And we did a whole series of those from helium-6 to beryllium-12, published a number of PRLs and letters here. And the key was we were able to do those because we have the fastest online system in the world. So what we need to do is produce these isotopes, diffuse them out the target, separate them, deliver them to the ion trap, do the preparation, do the mass measurement, and we can do all of that within 5 milliseconds. So it's the fastest system in the world. We reach the highest precision with that, sub-KV precision, and we have a very high limit of sensitivity. We only need 5 to 10 ions per second delivered to us to bring one ion of those into the trap at the time, and then we can carry out these precision experiments. And again, the red line is what was known before, and in this blue circle with the arrow bar is our measurement. The point I want to make here is that we always found the best agreement in our measurements when we compared to theory that took these three nucleon forces into account. So these are light system, beryllium-12, with 12 neutrons and protons, but it's an excellent benchmark to say, let's go and see whether we can do that for heavier systems. And that's what we tried here. We're moving on to calcium. And the story I want to tell here is what is called the evolution of magic numbers, or shells, in nuclear physics. We know that the atomic shell holds true for the entire periodic table. So I will ask again, who has seen a periodic table? Oh, it's a joke. So if you look at the noble gases, every time we find a new element with the right number of electrons, we know it's a noble gas. So this works wherever we go. It doesn't seem to be the case for the shell model for atomic physics. In fact, when Meyer Göppert and Hans Jensen found the shell model in nuclear physics, and just as a reminder, what I mean by that is there is a specific combination of neutrons and protons that lead to extra stability at closed shells. A noble gas has extra stability in the electrons. Closed shells in nuclear physics has extra stability before I can remove a neutron or a proton. When they found it 50 years ago, they didn't have access to rare isotopes. They looked at the stable isotopes, and there it worked. Everywhere they looked with this combination, they found extra stability. In fact, that's why they were called magic. When they looked, they found extra stability, and they couldn't explain it. There was no theoretical framework for that. They called it magic. They came up with a theoretical framework, which then resulted in the shell model for nuclear physics. Now we see that this doesn't work if you have a strong imbalance between neutrons and protons. So let's do a test case at calcium. What you see here is the single particle energy for protons in various neutron numbers, so we're going to heavier and heavier systems. And where you have extra large gap, this is where you find a shell gap or a magic number. Now, this shell gap depends on what kind of interaction you put into this calculation. These are all calculations. 28, we know, is stable. What kind of interaction is used here or here determines then whether the next shell gap is at 32 or 34. Now, what we want to do is include these three-body forces in our interaction and then, again, confront it with experiments. So this is what you see here in more detail, single particle energies and a phenomenological approach. This is what we used to do. We have a phenomenological approach in nuclear physics. Here we have a realistic two-nucleon interaction taken into account, or realistic two-nucleon and three-nucleon body interaction. And you see that you get different predictions for that. And you take these predictions and you plot that against the two neutron separation energy or the binding energy, and you get this blue curve out here. And you're confronted with the existing mass values at the time, which is black, and there was a large difference. In fact, it was about 2 MeV, pretty large. And then we came along and did mass measurements, and this is what you see here in red. And we found very nice agreement, which was at the time a true prediction from theory, taking three-body forces into account. So then my colleagues at Isotrap at CERN, where I did my PhD, they confirmed that and actually pushed that a little bit further out and were able to publish that this year in Nature. So they went out to calcium 54. So very nice confirmation of this theory that includes these three nucleon interactions. And there's complementary information now available, and this is where I come back to the experimental approach at RECAN. They did an in-flight production of calcium 54, and here you see the spectroscopy of excited states. You see here the experiment and here theoretical predictions, and these theoretical predictions, in fact, include these three nucleon interactions, and you see fairly good agreement with the measurement. And I like that. This is good agreement. So the explanation that you have here is, again, a little bit phenomenological. You have a series of isotopes that all have the same number of neutrons in this neutron shell here. This is the proton shell. And you deplete the number of the protons. You remove more and more protons. What it means, you change your unevenness between neutron and proton ratio because you remove protons. So you remove more and more protons, and in this case, there are no protons left. And that actually changes the interaction so much that the two neutrons move further and further away, generating a larger shell gap. What that means is that this simple approach that the strong interaction is charge independent, so it doesn't matter whether it's neutron or proton, no longer holds true here. So we have to have a proper interaction taken into account, which is then taken care of by these three-body forces. So as I said, it's very good agreement. I like that. And in fact, Nature liked it too. They put it on the cover. So this is what they had here. This is the experiment that they did at the facility in RECAN. So last example that I have is related to nuclear astrophysics. So this is the plot that we saw earlier, this post-processing simulation with the isotope abundance here. And this is what you have here in a more static picture. So here's that network calculation where the R process, the so-called R process, moves along here. And we did some mass measurements in this region, neutron-rich rubidium and strontium isotopes, and we'll come back to that. And when you did when you do these network calculations, this is the abundance that you get out here in red. And then you can confront it with the observations here in blue. So what do you see? It's horrible. It doesn't agree at all. So the blue observed don't agree at all with this calculated abundances here. So there's something wrong, obviously. And as I said, it could be in the model that you put in there. What kind of temperature you have, how many neutrons flow in, etc. Or it could simply be in the nuclear physics that you put in there. How quickly can you absorb these neutrons? How fast does the beta decay occur and change a neutron into a proton? How much energy is released, etc., etc. So we did what is called a sensitivity study. We did the simulation, this network calculation, and varied the available nuclear data by 3 sigma up and down. And then you get these two curves here using this mass values here. And you see the relative differences. So it's a large scatter all over. And then we did the measurements of those 6 isotopes that I showed earlier. And then we repeated that sensitivity, now including our 6 masses. And the uncertainty here completely vanishes. So that is pretty good, because we always thought there are so many isotopes involved in those network calculations. How can, you know, a few isotopes make a difference? Well, they do. So by measuring those 6 isotopes, the impact here is very large. And you see that it's all gone here. So what that means, you can remove the nuclear physics uncertainty, and now you can focus on the stellar explosion conditions. You can go back and talk to your neutron star merger or core collapse supernova colleagues and say, we've fixed our problem. Try to come up with conditions that are eventually able, and I go back to that slide, to reproduce the solar abundances that we really observe in the universe. All right, and with that, I'm already at the end. Come to a conclusion. Quickly summarize what have we learned. Atomic nuclei offer a rich field for study for some of the most fundamental questions in physics, and they are relevant. The key quest to answer some of those pressing questions is rooted in understanding what holds atoms together. We've seen that a theoretical first principle-based approach, a so-called ab initio approach, using quantum chromo-effective field theory, leads to good predictions for experimental properties. We want to expand this. We've done some benchmarking. We've done light nuclei, the so-called halo nuclei. We've done some neutron-rich calcium isotopes. And we've seen that these three nucleon forces are relevant. Why do we need rare isotopes? Because the effects only show up where you have a very strong neutron-to-proton ratio. They don't show up at the stable isotopes. I've showed some examples for halos and calcium. I just showed you the nuclear astrophysics and stellar objects and nuclear synthesis. To study these rare isotopes, we have to produce them. So you need a rare beam facility, which is typically accelerator-based. You can also go in a supernova, but I prefer an accelerator facility. You need to carry out these precision experiments. They need to be fast, precise, and to be precise, also accurate. And for that, I choose atomic physics tools, like ion traps, very potent to achieve that. Titan is the fastest and one of the most precise online trap system in the world, and in particular laid out to cover these very short-lived isotopes. But more and other complementary data is needed, as I've shown from this Recon data. Rare beams offer excellent science opportunities, more to come in the future, one rare isotope at the time. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention, and again for this nice opportunity to come out here and talk to you about my program. But I would also like to mention the people that actually do the work and not just talk about it. And these are the grad students that I have, and the postdocs, my long-term collaborators, and my colleagues from theory. Thank you very much.